This is WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. And you're listening to The Surreal News, and we want to thank Breakfast Bar and Have You Heard? Some great shows. And this morning, we have a packed show. My name is Steve Norris, and my co-host is Bradley. And Bradley's in the studio with us this morning. All right, Bradley.
How are you doing? Good to be here.
Good to be here.
Thanks.
So on our show this morning, Lou is out this morning, and we have Bradley in for him. Andy Mele, if I'm pronouncing that right, is here, and he's going to be talking to us. Say hello this morning.
Good morning.
All right. And he's going to be talking to us about that controversial issue having to do with Myakka State Park and whether they're going to allow cattle grazing there. And after that, we have, well, one of my favorite guests here, and that's Greg Pallast. And Greg Pallast is going to be reporting to us this week about the Deepwater Horizon and some of the information behind the scenes from Chelsea Manning that they discovered. Well, they sort of saw that coming. So we're going to be talking about the Deepwater Horizon business. We just had an anniversary about that. Before we get started, let me just mention that next week I have scheduled Dr. Eddie Rainier, who is on the task force for young black violence here in the state of Florida. And he is going to be joining us next week to tell us about what's going on with black violence really across the country and his views on it. I am so looking forward to that. And what he has to say about that. But first, we have some news items to go through, and Bradley's going to start us off and tell us about, well, the Florida Senate and what's going on with abortion. The Florida Senate has been busy, huh?
Yes, it has, Steve. The Florida Senate passes bill requiring 24-hour wait for abortions. The Florida Senate approved a bill on Friday mandating a 24-hour waiting period for women seeking abortions, with all Republicans voting in favor and all Democrats opposed. The bill is now headed to Republican Governor Rick Scott, who is expected to sign it into law. Senator Anthony Flores, a Miami Republican who sponsored the bill, said it was irresponsible for women to wait 24 hours after meeting with their doctors for an informed consent briefing on fetal development, which is already required by state law, and undergoing the abortion procedure itself. She noted that state law requires a 3-day waiting period for purchasing a gun or getting married and 20 days for divorces.
All right, very interesting. So there's our Florida state legislature, well, at work here. It just seems like they sort of pick and choose the things that they want to do and the things that they want to ignore. The next item has to do with the Supreme Court. So SCOTUS, the Supreme Court, on Monday, revived the religious objections by Catholic groups in Michigan and Tennessee to Obamacare requirement for contraceptive coverage, throwing out a lower court decision favoring President Obama's administration. And what's going on here, I'll summarize here, is that the Supreme Court ruled on Hobby Lobby that said that you could use religious objections to deny people, for example, some of their rights as employees. And in light of that, now the Supreme Court is telling lower courts to go back and review prior rulings they've had about Obamacare with people having religious objections to parts of Obamacare. For example, just giving contraception, which doesn't seem like a controversial thing. Now it is, in light of the Hobby Lobby ruling, where things have been completely changed. So, for example, they asked the Cincinnati-based court, U.S. Citrix Circuit Court, to reconsider a decision backed by the Obama administration that allowed privately owned corporations to seek exemptions from the provision. For example, services for women, access to contraception, sterilization, etc. Well, the Supreme Court continues in the news here. I don't know what to say here, but it looks like as a result of Hobby Lobby, we sort of feared that eventually that this would now then trickle down and we'd see religious objections to things that were otherwise, we thought were non-controversial. I don't know, Jazzy.
Crazy world.
This is just looking bad here.
Yeah,
because, I mean, my comment here, then we'll go on, is, you know, separation of church and state is kind of an important thing. And if you start to let people have religious objections to laws on the books that are basically protecting people, then our separation of church and state seems to just go out the window.
Yeah, it's a fine line there.
Yeah. All right, so next we had minority voting rights. And this also has to do sort of with the Supreme Court, which said that the Voting Rights Act was sort of trashed here, at least parts of it. So what did Senator Grassley, a Republican, have to say here?
Yeah, so Senator Chuck Grassley, he's the chairman of the Judicial Committee, said Monday that he doesn't expect to bring up legislation to restore the Voting Rights Act because lots of minority people are already voting. During an event at the National Press Club, Grassley was asked about the committee considering a bill that would fix the landmark 1965 law. The Supreme Court struck down Section 4 of the law in 2013, ruling that it needed to be updated. The section determined that which states and localities with a history of suppressing minority voters had to get permission from the Justice Department to change their voting laws. The justices instructed Congress to come up with a new formula for designing which regions of the country warranted special scrutiny. Grassley dismissed the idea that there's no need to act. It depends on what you want to fix, he said. If you want to fix more minority voting, more minorities are already voting. That's kind of an interesting.
Yeah. And also kind of in light of what we see across the country here, where, well, minorities are not really happy campers these days. If you look at Baltimore, you look at what's going on in Ferguson, of course, that has to do with some other issues, and we're going to talk about next week with Dr. Rainier about that topic. But also the voting issue is also high on people's list because, you know, not being represented is certainly another issue, too.
You would think it's a day and time everybody would have equal representation, and still there's people fighting.
Yeah, we have the problem with the Voting Act. So, and Grassley says there's no problem. Well, you know, the disconnect between people in Washington and their own sort of bubble and the rest of the country is getting to be such a wide disconnect there. It's just, they just have not a clue what's really going on here. You know, blaming a couple of violent protesters for everything. They're just so missing the point here. We have scores of young black kids without jobs. I mean, this is a problem.
Yeah,
we just can't ignore that.
The community as itself has a lot of issues. Everybody seems to know about it, but no one wants to seem to try and make some differences.
Yeah. I love what the Orioles owner said. I don't know if you heard his tweet, but you know they had a game without any attendance. But he said the real problem here is jobs for young black kids. I mean, he just so nailed it and got a lot of good publicity for it too. Did you have anything? You're shaking your head here. You're welcome to say anything if you want.
I actually have the quote here. It was so right thinking. That the Orioles owner was just spot on with that. He just came out of like, oh well, we've got a game here, we got to play a game. The typical sports talk, you know, yeah, we've got the whole thing is about playing the game. Right? And he goes off and he starts talking about how, you know, this is a societal problem that really needs to be addressed, and all these kids are not being represented. They're coming up feeling disenfranchised, and it's going to hit the fan someday. And wow.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well said. All right, we love to do our science items here. And the next one here is a mysterious cold spot, maybe the largest structure in the universe. This was recently found, the largest individual structure ever identified by humanity. So our galaxy, it's like a cluster of galaxies, or even a galaxy supercluster. It's not really even a structure. It's sort of a vast comet bubble, a super void, 1.8 billion light years across. And there's really no barrier there. Super voids are not completely empty. They're just under-dense. According to the astronomers, and this is popular science. And they said about 100,000 galaxies are missing. from this super void, and it's somewhat of a riddle as to what's going on there. We're not going to get to the details here. We don't have enough time to get to the details, but we love our surreal science stories, and here's another one. After this, let me just mention here, we're also going to go to the Russian spaceship, right? I'm going to do that one. So the Russian spaceship spun out of control. This is a unmanned spaceship. The mission control was unable to stabilize it. It was carrying 2.5 tons of food supplies for the International Space Station, but it didn't show up 6 hours after the launch. They're not giving up on the ship, and the crew members aboard the Space Center said, well, they got plenty of food. They're not in any immediate danger here. But we have a Russian spaceship, well, that kind of went not where you expect it to be. That was your story, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe the spaceship's like to go stop at 7-Eleven out there.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry, I read your story for you.
No problems.
Yeah, we're a little less organized here this morning. But I do want to mention the next one, and then I'll get you, then we go to Arizona. And that has to do with Tesla and its battery packs. And I did hear this a little bit, was reported in NPR this morning, and you're going to hear about this. So Tesla, the company that's making the electric cars, et cetera, they have a line out rechargeable lithium-ion battery packs that they've introduced last night that can store solar energy. So here at the radio station, we just had our drive here to get our next solar panels. We're about, I think, about a third or a little bit more solar now, and we're trying to go 70 to 100% solar with a new solar panels that we're putting up. The problem with the solar panels generally is storing that electricity. All right, so if there was a cheap, reliable battery that you could buy, then you could store the electricity during the day and use it all the time, and that's what's going on here. And these batteries that they're marketing are reasonably priced. We're not going to mention the price, but the price is about a seventh of what they thought it would be. So the prices are a lot less than what they for these batteries. Powerwall. They can mount it on a garage or outside a home. And there's a larger one called Power Pack, which can be used to power businesses. And the power wall is about 10 kilowatts, and you can stack them about 9 to get about 90 kilowatts. And the power pack is about 100 kilowatts for you nerdy people out there. And they're scalable. You can power businesses and even cities with them. So you can store solar energies. You can also draw energies from the electric grid during off-peak hours when the rates are lower, and store it and then use it for later use too. So like during the hot weather, everybody's using air conditioning, it's a peak time. What's interesting here, I'm just making a comment here, is that not all the power companies change the what they charge during peak and off-peak hours, which is interesting because you'd think they would, which would make this more cost-effective. So that doesn't necessarily match with what the power companies are doing here, and nobody's cooperating here.
No, I just read in the news a few weeks ago that one of the power companies in the state was thinking about charging a $50 flat fee for customers who go solar.
Yes, there's a penalty.
Kind of,
non-productive. Florida is not really very friendly there, and also there's limits on what if you can take your power and then sell it back to the power companies using your power, your solar power generators here. So there's a lot of issues. These are these lithium-ion batteries now available, Powerwall and PowerPack from Tesla. So Tesla in the news again. All right. By the way, just on the way out, just the messenger satellite that was orbiting around Mercury, we said that ran out of fuel. It was going to crash into Mercury. It did. It was going about 8,700 miles an hour, and its crater was about 52 feet across. This was totally expected. We reported that was going to happen last week. And indeed, say goodbye to the wonderful messenger satellite. They gave us lots of great pictures of Mercury.
The story of how they had to deal with the high temperatures there was fascinating. I heard that they had to like aim the cameras and sensors at the surface of Mercury and then pan away to keep from melting the equipment inside because the planet itself is so hot.
Really,
it was a complicated probe. It was a really cool thing.
Very cool.
That's interesting.
All right, so, well, we like to talk about sustainability and things like that. So Arizona, what are they doing?
So Arizona lawmakers forbid cities from enacting plastic bag bans. This is kind of interesting. Vexed by the litter caught in cactuses and shrubs, one Arizona city banned plastic bags on Earth Day of all days last year. Two others considered similar bans as part of a growing trend around the country to outlaw the single use of plastic bags as checkout at checkout counters. Those efforts are now in limbo after Arizona lawmakers voted this month to make it illegal for cities to impose bag bans, angering municipalities over what they see as heavy-handed actions by the state. It's a clash that has grown more intense as lawmakers here have taken an aggressive approach to recent years in curtailing the role of local government. Other conservative states are making similar moves to ban plastic. Move to ban plastic bag bans. Florida already has made it illegal for municipalities to ban plastic bags, and lawmakers are considering similar legislation in Missouri and Texas, said Jennifer Schultz, a policy analyst at the National Conference of State Legislators. That's an interesting thing. I notice when you go to the grocery store, more and more people are starting to bring their own bags, but there's a lot of plastic bags out there, especially in this state. It makes a difference when you have turtles coming up with it.
Yep. So here we have Arizona kind of heading in the wrong direction here. Not sure what they're thinking here, but going in the wrong way.
That's Arizona.
All right, so that's pretty much it for the news here. And let me remind everybody, you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. We're your true community radio station. And this is News and Public Affairs, your surreal news show, your weapon of mass instruction. That name was given to us by Greg Palast. He's coming up. It's about 9:35.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
35 minutes past the hour. For you Surreal News and Greg Palast fans, you don't want to miss this one. We're going to talk about Deepwater Horizon stuff you're just not going to hear elsewhere. Yeah, we have some news for you there. All right, but first, we have in the studio, I'm delighted to have Andy Nelly, who's a environmental scientist, I'd say, from Bard College, from New York.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where women go.
Sorry?
Brown.
Bard College?
Bard College is an old liberal arts school. It used to be St. Stephen's Academy and so on and so on. It's a great outfit. Private college, 1,000 people.
Okay. So you got your BA and MS from there, Executive Director of Hudson River Sloop Clearwater. From 1999 to 2005, you increased the organization's annual revenues there quite a bit. You were instrumental for the EPA in 2002. The record of record decision required General Electric to remove PCB contaminations from the upper Hudson River. I remember that going on. That was interesting stuff. We can talk about that, too. And also were instrumental in a court judgment against energy that required compliance with the NPDES and Clean Water Act in cooling systems at India Point.
The big nuke plant.
These are
both like 30-year battles that we managed to make some progress on.
So, you were there. And then from 94 to 98, you were environmental director at Clearwater, including a wide variety of water and quality issues, important in the early steps of development of Hudson River Park. You're author of Polluting for Pleasure, which was published in 93. And that talked about the magnitude of oil and gasoline pollution in America's waterways from two-stroke outboard motors, a big issue here in Florida. Of course, a lot of people are going to the four-strokes now, right? Personal watercraft.
Well, they're going to the four-strokes because of my book. I give myself a big pat on the back. I don't normally do that, but this is one. There were like 12, 13 million two-stroke engines running back then when I wrote the book. And it amounted to somewhere between 5 and 10 Exxon Valdez oil spills going into American waters every year. So I wrote the book. Some lawyers from the Sierra Club sued the EPA after reading it and got a marine engine rule. And now the market is completely transformed. The two-stroke engine is virtually extinct. And you can go out on the water without the sheen on the surface or the smoke and that distinctive smell drifting through the air. It's quiet and much more fuel efficient and everything.
Yeah, my comment is the four-stroke engine's a little bit heavier, a little bit more expensive, well worth it.
Yep.
For those of us who are on the water. Okay, now your Suncoast Waterkeeper for Sarasota, Manatee, Tampa Bay region. You have the affiliation with the International Waterkeeper Alliance. You're the chair of the Sierra Club, Sarasota Group's Conservation Committee, and now on the Surreal News Show in WSLR. Welcome.
I hit the big time.
You hit the big time here. Yes. All right, so what we want to talk about is a local issue. Before we do that, obviously reading your bio gives us a flavor of how you got to where you are now. But before we move on, tell us a little bit about sort of your passion and how you got here and why you're doing what you're doing.
I have multiple passions, unfortunately. Both my parents were writers, and so I've always wanted to write novels. And when I got the chance to go back to college and finish, I was a classic 60s dropout, but I got the chance to go back to school. I was like, literature or environment. It was a choice between those two. And I figured I'd have a better chance of at least making some sort of living in the environment and a better chance of making a difference. So I went that way and haven't looked back. But I'm still working on my fiction also. I write novels.
Oh, really?
I've got a novel done that I'm rewriting right now called The Book of Storms. And it's a novel of love, murder, and climate change. So hopefully that'll find me an agent at some point. Anyhow, any literary agents out there.
All right, we might have to have you back to talk about. We do have authors on this show.
Sure.
We might have to have you back. That sounds like that could be a good one. All right, what's the big issue here? All right, so tell us about what's going on in Myakka and why we should be concerned about it.
It ain't just going on in Myakka. It's going on statewide. It's a former DEP employee. There's a lot of former DEP employees now since Rick Scott came in.
DEP stands for?
Don't expect protection. I mean, Department of Environmental Protection.
Is this the one you're not allowed to use the words climate change?
That's the one. You remember that. That's been in the news. You're not allowed to use climate change. You're not allowed to say global warming. And they also drew up either sensing the zeitgeist from Tallahassee or having been directly instructed, they drew up in secret a 30-page management plan for the Florida parks, including Myakka, that called for things like logging, cattle grazing, and other forms of economic, you know, revenue generation. Basically mandating that the parks were going to have to pay their own way.
Mm. All right, so before this, the parks got funding from where?
The parks have gotten funded by the public, and that's how it was intended to be back in the 30s when the Florida parks were created. The intent was clear, absolutely clear. It was supposed to be a public amenity paid for by the public without commercialization. At various times there have been attempts to commercialize the parks. There have been proposals for, you know, Disney-esque sorts of things like water slides and tourist, you know, western villages and all this sort of garbage. And fortunately, the parks have stood fast. The motto is the real Florida. You can't really hate cattle grazing because cattle grazing is a part of the beauty of the interior. You see, you know, you drive past these, you know, pastoral landscapes and you see the cows grazing, and it's cool. It's just not appropriate for the park.
Yes, and I guess, you know, you think of parks, you know, little boy Johnny wants to go to the park and maybe, go on the swings or whatever. I can't see how Coca-Cola should be involved with that or some other big company or... So what is the thought here? The thought is that the parks now are going to be required, what, to make generate their own funds to keep themselves
going? They're going to be required to, I guess, break even. There's conflicting information about whether Myakka, there's reports that say that Myakka State Park pays its own way and then some, and is a donor park, essentially creating a surplus that goes into the system. And there's another set of information that says it doesn't pay its own way, so I'm a little puzzled about that. You'd think we could figure that out. But anyhow, I don't think anybody's talking about Coca-Cola or corporate sponsorship, although I'm sure that they would, you know, welcome that too, that particular faction in Tallahassee that loves this stuff. But I think they're just right now talking about 6,000 or 7,000 acres of what's now reverted to native prairie-like ecological structure, and turning that into grazing land, which means putting up fences, putting in roads, and so on and so forth. And one of the ways they're talking about extracting payment for this is through in-kind services. The ranchers would provide in-kind services. They'd run, they prescribed burns and all that, and certain other things. You know, one is concerned about roadways. One is concerned about the structure of those 7,000 acres. That's a lot of land. One is concerned about sending a message. You know, people who come to this area who spend their money, generously, one hopes, they come for two things. They come to watch birds, and they come to go to the beach. And Manaka Park is bird central. It's also gator central. Everybody who wants to see an alligator, take, you know, Johnny wants to go on the swing. It has nothing to do with it. They want to go see the gators. And so that park has tens of thousands of visitors, hundreds of thousands of visitors. It's incredibly popular with the visitors. Walking around the corner, driving around the corner, and finding yourself in the middle of a cow pasture will impact that or not is to be seen. I think that the whole thing is it emanates from a particular stripe of political economy, politician, conservatives, let's not mince words, who detest any and all public assets. They just don't like public assets. They're still fighting the Cold War. They think anything public is smacking of socialism, and that goes for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and pensions. They hate that. They just want to privatize everything. They would like to privatize the national park. They privatize the prisons, and it's all, you know, under the rubric of balancing the budget. But most of these conservative administrations have only succeeded in deepening the holes around us. Anyhow, I think it's a red herring. Personally, it's just, I don't have any other particular support for this, but they're after Amendment 1, big time.
So explain a little bit, and just let me just let people know you're listening to Andy Melly. He is currently the waterkeeper for Sarasota Manatee Tampa. He's also the chair of Sarasota Sierra Club here, and he's talking to us about what's going on in Manaka. So break us apart here, what Amendment 1, what we thought it was going to be, and what they're actually doing with it.
Yeah, we thought Amendment 1, it was written pretty clearly. I think the idea was it was written clearly enough to withstand a legal challenge, to support a legal challenge based on the anticipated grab such as is occurring today. The right side of the chamber up in Tallahassee would like to basically reappropriate all that money because, again, they're allergic to anything that's a public source of funding, any public pool of money. Amendment 1 is a classic in that regard. And turn it into things like paying for upgrades to water treatment plants and filling holes in the budget and stuff like that. Just turn it into cash, good liquid cash, and not spend it on. They say that we haven't preserved enough land. I think a cursory look at the interior floor would say that's not true. Anyhow, I think that in the middle of all this, they're creating this furor, this Sturm und Drang about the parks, in order to create a situation in which the tree huggers will say, "Oh, you want to take Amendment 1? Take Amendment 1, please, and use it for the public parks. We got to save the public parks." And so they'll be able to go into the Amendment 1 money and put it into the parks and still declare victory and be able can shrink the budget by giving tax breaks to the rich.
I walk through that one more time. So we have Amendment 1, which was supposed to buy...
supposed to fund the purchase and maintenance of land.
And then we have the administration basically attacking parks and making them become self-sufficient as a backdoor measure to apply Amendment 1 to save our parks? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
That's pretty conniving, huh? Mm-hmm. So this is all kind of done behind the scenes.
That's what I think. It's not in writing anywhere. I'd have a hard time proving this, but I'd bet good money on it.
All right, we're just about at half past the hour. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPF on the Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. There's news and public affairs. Andy Melle is here from the Sierra Club and other things talking to us about Myakka Park. All right, what's wrong? What else is wrong with having cattle grazing all over our parks?
Well, there's the slippery slope issue. You know, if cattle today, logging tomorrow, and God knows what the next day. The logging is really intrusive, and the county's logged a lot of the public lands, claiming that it's a fire suppression, but big trees are not the source of the fire problem. It's the undergrowth that's the source of the fire problem, and when you do prescribed burns, it's always to burn off the undergrowth so it doesn't get too big. You don't build up too much fuel on the forest floor. So logging is incredibly destructive. It just tramples everything around it. You get these roads that would take millennia to disappear from the tread of the log skidders and everything like that. So there's the general Myakka Park was rangeland at one time. Much of it, part of it was. Part of it remained pristine, but it was farmed. It was ag land into the 30s, which is basically when the parks system was created. So it's not wildly inappropriate to have some cattle there. But the thing is that the parks are not intended. The mission of the Florida State Parks is to preserve land for educational and recreational use in as close to a pristine state as you can get. And rolling back the clock for a few short-term bucks is not in keeping with the mission of the Florida Parks.
All right, I think we're coming near the end here, and I think many of our listeners, because you're involved with other things, would like to know a little bit about, just as you're the water keeper, and generally about the state of the water. Can I ask you a question or two about that, because you have knowledge there?
Go for it.
Would you mind? Okay, so tell us about what's going on in the water, since you are a water keeper for this area. What do we need to know?
We need to know that there's a lot more of a pesticide burden in our waters than we know. Nobody's testing for the pesticides. I'm trying to raise some money to do some independent testing. The Army Corps of Engineers has decided that it's not going to bother to do an environmental impact study. It's going to go ahead and dredge out the Big Pass Shoal to replenish the beach at Lido Key with no sense of confidence for us that this is not going to create a disaster. You know, the last time they did a dredge project of this scale, this magnitude, which was the construction of Bird Key, the entire bay was smothered in silt and essentially rendered a desert. The bay was killed by the last big dredging project this size. And we're not going to let that happen. We have very politely requested an EIS. They're saying, no, we're just going to forge ahead with this
environmental
assessment. Yeah, under NPDES, National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, which has failed to eliminate much of anything, but at least its great intent, really requires a full-blown environmental impact study for projects of this magnitude. And the Corps, perhaps sniffing the political winds, is just saying, yeah, we don't have to do that. We have an environmental assessment. It's 12 years old, but that's good enough. We'll just change the date on the paper and go for it. It's just bad to the bone. There was stuff in the paper today about sea turtles being killed by a beach replenishment project. It needs to be done really carefully, and it needs to be done with, we believe, an area-wide study, a hydrology study, because they're going to also be dredging two of the other passes. That could have a significant impact on the bays. You know, people driving across the bridges, people coming to Sarasota, they look out at that azure waters of the bay, and they just, you know, their shoulders go down, they exhale, it's almost as, you know, you're on your way out to the beaches and you're looking at the bay, and it's just a whole part of the package. We've got to protect the bay, got to protect the ecosystems that are in there, and that's what we're doing. Blinking lights, phone calls.
That's okay. So on our way out for our listeners, let's say they want to do something here. So our listeners here are interested in helping out. In just a minute, is there a website they can go to get more information? Is there is there something that we could do just as citizens or as members of the community?
Well, mostly just keep an eye on things. The you can go to Suncoast Waterkeeper. That's all one word, .org, and look under the top navigation tab that says what we do, and there's a pretty good description of the dredging project there. Contact us at the website or contact the Sierra Club. One of the best things to do is to join either or both organizations and stay connected and continue to follow on an informational basis what's happening. There's also a move afoot on the part of this county commission to privatize a lot of public lands, and we are fighting that as much as we can. The county commission is being asked to rezone a 50-acre patch of incredibly high-quality habitat that's just south of the University Town Center. It's a swift mud easement for the Cooper Creek. It's part of the Bradenton drinking water watershed, and they're going to build it out. It's just, you know, it's supposed to be protected in perpetuity. So, stay tuned, and we look for your support, and we sure do need it.
All right. Again, I just want to thank Andy Mellon, who's joined us in the studio here, who's involved with the Sierra Club. He's involved with the Waterkeeper. He's a Suncoast Waterkeeper for this area. He's also an author. He's going to have a book coming out. That'll be interesting as well. And I think this is an excellent segue for our next guest. Let me just remind people, you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. This is News and Public Affairs, Surreal News Show, your weapon of mass instruction. And that name was given to us by a certain Greg Palace. Good morning, Greg.
Glad to be with you, Steve.
And we are so glad to have you back. Greg Palace is a BBC reporter. He's also has various books that he's written, and one of them is Vultures and Vote Rustlers. Actually, that's his film. And we have Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, his book as well. Today, we're going to switch gears. We were talking about the waters and the area here locally in the Sarasota area, and also our parks as well. And there you're going to talk to us about some things having to do with the other waters where the Deepwater Horizon was going on. So tell us what's going on there. We just had an anniversary, correct?
Yes, this is the fifth anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon blowout, and the 11 men were burnt to death on that oil rig, BP's oil rig. And it's also the fifth anniversary of a massive cover-up. And, you know, for those who don't know me, and a lot of people do in the Bradenton, Sarasota area, I'm an investigative reporter. Probably best known in your area is the guy that uncovered how your one-time Congresswoman, Secretary of State Catherine Harris, you know, removed thousands of black folk as felons from the voter rolls of Florida. 2000. We uncovered that, but I've been working on a lot of beats besides vote theft. It's because one asks the question, why do companies, why do billionaires fund the theft of votes? Because people steal votes for a reason, and it's not to win elections, it's to follow the money. In the case of BP, of the BP explosion right after the Deepwater Horizon blew out and sank, destroyed most of the coastline of the Gulf Coast. You were pretty lucky getting very little coming into your way, just to stop just before you. What they didn't tell you is that 17 months before the Deepwater Horizon blew, there was another BP offshore blowout, identical. It was almost a mirror of what happened in the Gulf of Deepwater Horizon, except it happened in the Caspian Sea on the other side of the planet in Asia, off the coast of the nation of Azerbaijan. Its capital is Baku. Don't worry if you've never heard of Baku. You know, it's an oil state, so we'll find out when the 101st Airborne arrives there. That's how we find out most of the oil state's capitals, whether it's, you know, Mogadishu or Tripoli or Saigon. That's how we find out about nation's capitals when our troops arrive there. So I'm giving you the advance info on one of our next oil wars. But the important thing is that there was an identical blowout, and BP never admitted to it. And if they had admitted to the blowout in the first place, and the reason I know about it is I actually got a tip-off from someone actually floating in the Caspian Sea who saw the Deepwater Horizon blowout, had watched it, and told me that they were floating in the Caspian Sea when they saw the blowout at the other BP rig. And I flew all the way to Asia for British television. I usually work for BBC. In this case, it was BBC's rival called Channel 4 for their main news program called Dispatches. And we snuck in with a camera on a cockamamie story that we were doing an investigation. We were doing a profile on the wonders of this, what I call the Islamic State of BP, Azerbaijan. And we found out that, indeed, you know, there had been a blowout before. BP covers up. Now, here's the problem with the cover up BP thing. Under U.S. law, under international law, you're supposed to say if you've had a blowout, a dangerous blowout. BP covered it up. They lied in their documents to the U.S. government. And their guy, David Rainey, head of BP in the Gulf of Mexico, under oath told Congress that he had no problem with offshore drilling. He said that, and you know, what's ill-making is 6 months before the Deepwater Horizon blew out, before it had begun drilling, Rainey said that they had no problem with Deepwater drilling. You should understand the Department of Interior did not want the Deepwater Horizon to drill where it was drilling. And he went before Congress to use congressional pressure successfully to allow the Deepwater Horizon to drill in that area. Now, why did the Deepwater Horizon blow out? It used a cheap, because BP used a cheap method of drilling called using what's called quick dry cement. It's laced with nitrogen, Steve. And by the way, all this information is laid out in my book, Vulture's Picnic. But what happened was they use this method called quick dry cement method. Now, cement is what you use to cap a well after you've drilled it. Remember, BP had drilled this well at tremendous pressure, so you cap it by putting cement into the well hole, into the pipe. But it blew out. Why did it blow out? Because when you put nitrogen, when you mix nitrogen and cement, why did they, you know, you've heard the phrase, Steve, oh, watching cement dry, because it takes forever. Well, one way to make cement dry quickly is you put nitrogen and makes it like a milkshake. There's lots of bubbles, and it's like air, so it dries quicker. And the only trouble is, if you've ever blown through a straw into a milkshake, it creates bubbles, and that can create channeling, so it can blow out. They should have never used quick dry cement in that high-pressure, deep-water area. Why not? Because it blew out 17 months before. It saves money. Every day you have a drill rig sitting on top of that hole is $500,000 in rental fees. So to save money, BP used this quick dry, cheap, money-saving method. in Asia, it blew out. 17 months later, they hid it. 17 months later, they used it again, and it failed again. 11 men died in the Gulf of Mexico, and the waters were poisoned. And who knows how many people are going to die from the cancers and hydrocarbons that were released, you know, just basically a monster wave of poison. And we could have prevented this, one, if BP had been honest, and two, if we had paid attention to Chelsea Manning's warnings.
So these were the leaked cables, and they told us a little bit about what the State Department was doing. And Condoleezza Rice was involved with this, too. She has some background here.
Yes, yeah, so one of the evil stories of this, I got a tip that this blowout happened. I flew all the way to Azerbaijan. By the way, if you go to gregpalace.com, you can see the story, and there's a little photo of me under arrest. And later, the reason I have film of this is that they took our camera film, but I had one of those little James Bond cameras inside my pen. They didn't think they didn't worry about what I was writing down, but I was doing more than writing. But here's where Chelsea Manning figures into it and the WikiLeaks documents. Excuse me. I was arrested in Azerbaijan. My witnesses were disappeared, so I ended up not being able to prove my story by itself. I just had the insiders, but couldn't get them on camera. I was thrown out of the country. But then I flew back, and I work with the Guardian newspapers. There's no great balance over with the Guardian newspapers. And my colleagues there had access to all the WikiLeaks documents. And lo and behold, in the WikiLeaks documents released by Chelsea Manning, there was a cable written by our ambassador to this Asian nation, which I call the Islamic Republic of BP, Azerbaijan. Our ambassador to Azerbaijan held a secret meeting with BP's president of BP, Azerbaijan. And in that secret meeting, the president of BP said, "We had a terrible blowout at this rig because of the cement, because our cement failed. That is, the quick dry nitrogen cement failed." So they knew, our State Department knew. Now, why did the State Department even ask this guy what was going on at his oil rig? Why the secret meeting? The answer goes back to Chevron. Condoleezza and the ambassador's boss at the time, this was the last months of the Bush regime, and Condoleezza Rice was Secretary of State. Chevron, and she had been on the board of directors of Chevron. Chevron and Exxon complained that they weren't getting any money from their partnership with BP in the Caspian Sea. See, BP was drilling these deep water wells in the Caspian in this quick, sloppy, penny-pinching manner. They had a blowout, and suddenly all the oil stopped flowing because you couldn't get near the rig. That rig, by the way, didn't blow because no one ignited it. You couldn't get near the rig. So that BP had stopped paying Chevron and Exxon their money from the oil rig in from the big operation of Azerbaijan because no oil was flowing, and they wouldn't tell. They wouldn't tell Chevron and Exxon what was going on, because they told Chevron and Exxon they would have to tell the U.S. regulators, who would then shut down the Gulf operation, or tell them to do it in a safe manner. You can't use cheap, quick, dry cement. So they were all shtum. Now, here's the evil of it. So this information, this cable, went from Azerbaijan, the secret meeting between BP and our own State Department about this terrible blowout in the Caspian Sea, and went to Washington, D.C. Condi Rice goes to the superiors, and the superiors of this is the office of Condi Rice receives this stuff. And Chevron was informed of what happened. Exxon was informed of what happened. Those around Condi Rice, if not Condi herself, were told. Obviously, BP knew. And they all agreed to hide it. So our own government participated in the cover-up, in the fraud upon the United States Congress, a fraud upon the workers and people of the Gulf, They hid this information that could have saved those 11 lives. They hid the information that could have prevented the deep water rise and blowout. The Interior Department simply did not want those guys to drill there at all, and they lied and said it was safe, that they'd never had a problem in 50 years. That was a statement by David Rainey, the vice president in charge of Gulf exploration. And Chelsea Manning tried to warn us. And who ended up in prison? The guy who told the lie? Condi Rice? The company that killed 11 guys in the Gulf? No, who ended up in prison? The guy that tried to warn us, Chelsea Manning. Now the woman. But at that time, Chelsea Manning was a truth teller. And he could have saved those lives if they didn't try to suppress that information. Now, Manning, I have no doubt, had no idea this cable was in his possession when he released it. But they're always talking about, oh, the things he could have exposed, that we were hunting for Osama bin Laden, as if bin Laden were hunting for him. But I got to tell you, I went through those cables. I went through those cables. And thousands of pages of material about helping out U.S. corporations on the sly. It was all about the money and the oil, and that's what it was about, the mining and the, you know, trying to gather secret information on the personal lives of foreign leaders. Some of it's quite funny, actually. The wife of the president of Azerbaijan, they said, had so many facelifts that she was incapable of forming facial expressions. And, you know, so you know, this is what they're sending. It wasn't about fighting terrorism. I didn't find a single cable, Steve, about fighting terrorism. Not one about potential terrorist attacks or look out for terrorists or look out for bad guys. It was all this stuff about helping our corporations grab the oil and keeping quiet about corporate tricks and games.
All right, let me remind people. This is Greg Pallas. You're listening to our fabulous investigative reporter telling us about the secret stuff about what's going on behind the scenes with the Deepwater Horizon. Obviously, this could have been prevented. And I guess my next question to you, where you're sort of going, is, you know, in the past we had whistleblowers, and if you told the truth, you know, nobody was going to go after you. And I thought whistleblowers were encouraged to tell the truth, and if they told the truth, that they would be protected, like Daniel Ellsberg, for example.
That's the horror here. Remember, Daniel Ellsberg really, Chelsea Manning did not release a single document, I'm telling you, I've read thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of the WikiLeaks documents, and they still have yet to show us a document in the Wiki within the Manning's release. It's all State Department stuff, by the way. It was never the military. He didn't release any military documents. I want to emphasize it. People don't recognize it. He was in the military, but he never released a single military document. It was only State Department information. That stuff is our diplomat speaking to the world. We actually should see that stuff. It's our information. Anyway, Manning, excuse me, a little bit of anthrax or something. Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers. He was a CIA officer releasing information, military information, about a war that was ongoing. If you think you're going to go to jail for espionage, that would be it. But the judge, Stanley Sporkin, released Ellsberg and said, because what Ellsberg did, he didn't sell the Pentagon Papers to the Vietnamese and the Chinese and the Russians. He gave them to the public. And the judge said, you can't arrest a man for sedition or espionage or anything like that because he's made information public, because we are unique in the United States. We have a constitution that we are free and open. We are a free and open republic. Our government does not keep secrets from its people. We might keep secrets from Russia. We might keep secrets from China. But we don't keep secrets from our own people. And all Daniel Ellsberg did was tell the owners of the information, us. Now, what makes Sporkin interesting is the judge. He was general counsel to the CIA. He was the chief lawyer for our spy agency. And he said, you know what? We don't have an Official Secrets Act in the United States like Saudi Arabia or the United Kingdom. We don't have an Official Secrets Act. Our officials don't have secrets. It's we, the people, that own that stuff. And he let Ellsberg go, who released serious military information. But thank God he did. It was the information that we were losing the war in Vietnam and not winning it. Open people's eyes.
And
but
on Yeah, on the same subject. Go ahead.
Chelsea Manning got 35 years in prison. 35 years in prison for telling the truth on these guys. It, the stuff in Manning's documentation is astonishing. We talk about WikiLeaks, but people don't understand what's in that. It's about cover-ups by corporations. This is the whole deal. It's about the deals we are making privately on behalf. It's basically our State Department has become nothing but a commercial front operation. Basically, commercial espionage is what we're doing. And the victims are not only the people of these other nations, like Azerbaijan, but it comes back to ourselves. Those 11 men died because our own State Department conspired with BP and Exxon and Chevron to cover up these facts. Chelsea Manning was trying to warn us, and he got 35 years in prison, and Hillary Clinton applauded that. Bill Clinton applauded these things. Needless to say, the right wing, if you go on Fox TV, they were literally saying we ought to execute Chelsea Manning for telling the public the truth that could have saved lives. It really could have saved lives. And I got to tell you, Steve, I want people to know, if you want the full story, I've made available, I've extended this, by the way, through the courtesy of a foundation, the Puffin Foundation. I have a film of my investigations, Vultures and Vote Rustlers, which has this investigation and other investigations I did for BBC. If you want to get the film, you can download it for free. Go to gregpalace.com. I can only keep it up free for a few days. You can always make a donation to our foundation, but it doesn't matter. I want you to download this thing for free. Get it today. The next 2 days we'll keep it open. So if you go to gregpalace.com, G-R-E-G-P-A-L-A-S-T, you can download the film, Vultures and Vote Rustlers, no charge. Seriously, there's no charge, no gimmicks here. And you get the story yourself.
That's great. And we encourage everybody to do that. That's required watching for our Surreal News listeners out there. Your stuff is fabulous. And I'll tell you, one of my favorite parts, you mentioned it before with the pen, that was one of my favorite parts of your book, when they said that they took everything and they didn't take your pen, and that had some photographs in it. That was a great story.
Who reads today? So they took everything but my... of my pen, which had a little video camera in it. So I got the information out. And, in fact, I used the video camera for another reason. When they decided they put us under arrest and they released us, then it looked like they were coming to get us again at the hotel. So we, you know, decided to bug out. But I used the cell pen to take pictures of all these documents I had.
Right.
And so I could then get rid of all the documents before the secret police arrived. And this is, you know, this is type of investigative reporting, by the way, you don't do in the United States of America. You know, go out and get the stuff, the inside documents, and find out what's going on. And rather, you know, I mean, by the way, it's interesting that now I'm telling you this story about, which was on the top of the nightly news in Britain and all over the world. So even the British public found out what BP was up to. That they knew that there had been a prior blowout in Asia before the Deepwater Horizon blowout. So even in Britain, the people were given that information. In the United States, this story still has not been broadcast. It has not been printed in the United States, except in my book, Vulture's Picnic. Why? Well, consider the petroleum broadcast system. In the PBS story about the Deepwater Horizon, they had a Chevron president get up and say on PBS, if this were Chevron, this would not have happened because we are so safe. Chevron was involved in the prior blowout in the Caspian. They never ran that story. And they didn't disclose, PBS did not disclose that Chevron is the official national sponsor of the PBS NewsHour.
There you go. Wow. All right, Greg, we're just about there. I encourage everybody. You said the film is available for no charge. They can go right now. Do it. GregPalace.com, correct?
Yes, GregPalace.com. Show up because you can donate if you want. Really, you can take it for free. I want people to have the information spreading around because it's only through your weapon of mass destruction, WSLR, and through getting to the Greg Palast website, that we can get the information that I give to the big networks around the world but never gets through the electronic Berlin Wall in America. Go to gregpalast.com and keep listening to your weapon of mass destruction in Florida. Thank you, Steve. I got to tell you, it's a tremendous outlet, and it allows me to really get home.
You are so appreciated here. Thank you, Greg Palast, our investigative reporter. Have a great day. All right, my favorite is Greg Palast. All right, we just have a couple seconds. Go ahead, Bradley, tell us.
I just wanted everybody to know the Sarasota County Park Recreation and Natural Resources. Just want to remind residents and visitors that it's the 43rd Annual Amateur Sand Sculpture Contest, which is on Sandy Beach.
That's correct.
And it's going to be Saturday. And actually, back in the day, came in first for that contest.
All right, also, Sunday, La Lucha at Fogartyville, Sunday, May 3rd. The news and views here are not those of WSLR. It's board members, it's volunteers, just to the people that gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. We have complex waveforms, which is coming up right now.